Support for this podcast comes from Avangrid.
This is definitely a blue-collar community, and I'm kind of a blue-collar guy.
Rick Sealscott didn't see himself as a farmer, but wasn't about to sell his grandparents' Ohio farm. An Avangrid wind farm pays millions to the community and landowners like him each year.
Farming's up and down, but the wind turbines give us steady income. We're holding on to the farm, and we're making money. And I would absolutely do it again.
Discover where energy meets humanity at avangrid.com.
From the New York Times, I'm Michael Barbaro. This is The Daily. Today, President Trump says peace in the Middle East does not require a two-state deal. That's a remarkable break from decades of American diplomacy. Then, a Times investigation reveals that Trump's campaign team was in repeated communication with Russian intelligence officials in the months leading up to the election. What we know and what we don't. And the president's controversial pick for Labor Secretary, Andrew Puzder, has withdrawn his nomination. Why Republicans turned on him. It's Thursday, February 16th.
Today I have the honor of welcoming my friend, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, to the White House.
During his presidency, Barack Obama's meetings with the Prime Minister of Israel had a distinctly uncomfortable feel.
With this visit, the United States again reaffirms our unbreakable bond with our cherished ally, Israel.
The differences between the two leaders, both in style and outlook, seemed unbridgeable. On Wednesday in the White House, we saw a new relationship.
President Trump, thank you for the truly warm hospitality you and Melania have shown me, my wife Sarah, our entire delegation. I deeply value your friendship. To me, to the state of Israel, it was so clearly evident in the words you just spoke.
President Trump was focused on what he wants.
The United States will encourage a peace and really a great peace deal. We'll be working on it very, very diligently.
Israel, he said, will have to do its part.
As with any successful negotiation, both sides will have to make compromises. You know that, right?
Both sides.
Netanyahu repeated it, both sides. For Israel, Trump said, that means holding back on new settlements for the moment. None of this was new from an American president, but what Trump said next was.
Mr. President.
A reporter asked the big question.
In your vision for the new Middle East peace, are you ready to give up of the notion of two-state solution?
So I'm looking at two-state and one-state. And I like the one that both parties like. I'm very happy with the one that both parties like. I can live with either one. I thought for a while the two-state looked like it may be the easier of the two. But honestly, if Bibi and if the Palestinians, if Israel and the Palestinians are happy, I'm happy with the one they like the best.
Here's how the world heard that. The United States will no longer insist on a separate Palestinian state as part of a peace deal between Israel and the Palestinians. With those comments, Trump directly broke with decades of American diplomatic tradition and confused and infuriated Palestinians who said this would threaten whatever slim chance is left for a peace deal.
Bibi and I have known each other a long time.
But at the White House on Wednesday, the focus was on Israel, the United States, and a deal.
A smart man, great negotiator, and I think we're going to make a deal. It might be a bigger and better deal than people in this room even understand. That's a possibility. So let's see what we do.
Let's try it.
Doesn't sound too optimistic, but that's it's good negotiator.
That's the art of the deal.
A New York Times investigation this week drew on phone records and intercepted phone calls to reveal yet another connection between President Trump and the Russian government.
We now know that there were conversations between Trump campaign advisors and Russian intelligence officials in the year before the November election.
Mark Mazzetti is the Washington investigations editor at the Times. He's a Pulitzer Prize winner and a longtime national security reporter. He co-wrote the investigation. To understand why those conversations have such enormous implications, you have to go back to the presidential campaign.
They matter because the American intelligence community has stated with very full confidence that the Russian government was involved in an extensive campaign of trying to sabotage the presidential election. And they also concluded that they were trying to do it to help President Trump. So the Russian intelligence services have been identified as a bad actor in last year's campaign. We're still trying to figure out how extensive the contacts were, how frequent they were, and really most importantly, what they were talking about, because that's really the key here.
So it feels like the timing really matters here. Precisely when, in 2016, as best you know, were these taking place?
What the reporting showed is they were occurring around the time that the intelligence agencies were beginning to figure out that the Russians were disrupting the election, the hacking was going on. So that happened. They discovered that in the spring of 2016. We think that some of these conversations were going on during that period and even later. Now, there's a lag time here because what happens is these communications get listened to by the National Security Agency, which vacuums up all conversations, basically, that Russian intelligence folks are having. And it's only after they are told, hey, go look at this, that they then go back into their archives and they look at specific conversations. So in other words, you know, the conversations may have happened earlier in 2016,
right,
but they may have only been analyzed in months later in the summer. Once the FBI started thinking, hey, there's something weird going on here, hey, you guys go back and look at those calls.
So given that timing and given that these conversations appear to be happening around the time, as you just said, of this effort to disrupt the American election, it seems like the big and obvious and important question is whether that timing is a coincidence or not.
It is the big, obvious, and important question, yes. I mean, you know, is it a coincidence or were there any discussions about these Russian efforts? That would be a very, very big deal if it were true. And I should say that we do not have any evidence of this yet. And there may not be evidence of it. There's still a lot we don't know, but it sort of gets to this bigger question, which is just why is President Trump so, I guess, strange when it comes to Russia? Why
he is really very much of a leader. I mean,
he certainly has been very upfront about his respect, even admiration for Vladimir Putin.
He's been a leader far more than our president has been a leader. We have a divided country.
A couple weeks ago, we gave an interview to Bill O'Reilly when O'Reilly mentioned that
Putin's a killer. A lot of killers. We got a lot of killers. Why, you think our country's so innocent? You think our country's so innocent?
Trump kind of came to his defense and almost said, well, we have a lot of killers in America too. And also his strange behavior the late last year in his really refusal to accept the conclusions of the intelligence community about the Russian hack.
I think it was disgraceful that the intelligence agencies allowed any information that turned out to be so false and fake out. I think it's a disgrace. And I say that. And that's something that Nazi Germany would have done and did do. I think it's a disgrace.
Now everyone is leaking, and it was certainly put off a lot of people in the intelligence world. And certainly an easy explanation could be that, you know, Trump didn't like people casting aspersions on his election or questioning its legitimacy, and that's entirely a very valid question. But the other question is just, you know, if the intelligence communities have just concluded with high confidence that the Russian government tried to sabotage an American presidential election.
The CIA has concluded that Russia intervened in the election to help you win the presidency.
You would think that the incoming president would take that pretty seriously.
Your reaction?
I think it's ridiculous. I think it's just another excuse. I don't believe it. I don't know why. And I think it's just, you know, they talked about all sorts of things. Every week it's another excuse. We had a massive landslide victory, as you know, in the Electoral College.
I wonder if there's a way of looking at all of this where there's potentially absolutely nothing wrong with these communications. Or is it inherently problematic for people on a presidential campaign or close to it to be talking to a country like Russia because it's seen as one of the biggest, maybe the biggest, adversary and threat to the United States.
It should be said that there's nothing inherently wrong about people on a presidential campaign talking with leaders of foreign countries, full stop. So it is a valid question to ask, is there anything wrong with this? Are there innocent explanations? Of course there are. People who are associated with Donald Trump who are businessmen may have come into contact with Russian intelligence officials unwittingly. In other words, they didn't know they were talking to Russian intelligence officials. They were talking to government people in the core for the course of their business.
Right.
You know, there are any number of explanations that we have to try to get to the bottom of. But we do think that it is significant and worthwhile to note that these conversations did happen and then try to go from there.
Where does this story go now? And what are you looking at next?
It is always the push to get more clarity about, you know, we know what the questions are. We know all these things we've just been discussing. Was there collusion? What were the discussions about? Who was on the phone? Who was making these contacts?
Right.
I mean, it's to basically fill in a picture that still is still very much kind of a blank canvas. So if we fill in a picture and we don't even know what it will ultimately look like, but if we do it, we will then sort of hopefully explain what is to make of this very, very strange set of circumstances. So we want to find out more of these contacts. We want to find out more of what has been swirling around about, you know, any past business ties that Donald Trump might have to Russia. There's sort of things that won't go away. And, you know, at the very least, maybe we can sort of dig down and say, you know what, we looked and there's no there there.
Thank you very much. Good luck with the rest of the reporting.
Thanks, guys.
On Wednesday night, we learned that Donald Trump plans to ask a New York billionaire, Steven Feinberg, to lead a broad review of American intelligence agencies. Members of the intelligence community who are still examining the president's ties to Russia have expressed fear that the review could limit their independence. We'll be right back.
This podcast is supported by ACLU. The ACLU knows exactly what threats a second Donald Trump term presents. And they are ready with a battle-tested playbook. The ACLU took legal action against the first Trump administration 434 times, and they will do it again to protect immigrants' rights, defend reproductive freedom, safeguard free speech, and fight for all of our fundamental civil rights. Join the ACLU today to help stop the Extreme Project 2025 agenda. Learn more at ACLU.org.
Hey, it's John Chase.
And Mari Uehara.
From Wirecutter, the product recommendation service from the New York Times. Mari, it is gift-giving time. What's an easy gift for someone like under 50 bucks?
So in our Gifts Under 50 guide, we have this super cute palm-sized Bluetooth speaker. It comes in an array of cool colors. It's waterproof. You can bring it anywhere. I want one for my garden.
I love it. Check out all of Wirecutter's gift recommendations for yourself and everyone else at nytimes.com/holiday guide.
On December 8th, Donald Trump nominated Andrew Puzder to serve as the Secretary of Labor. Now, if you work for a living, this man is important to you. Unfortunately, Mr. Puzder is not the kind of American person that workers can trust to stand up for them.
In the U.S. Senate, President Trump's cabinet appointments have moved through the confirmation process at an unusually slow pace, touching off controversy after controversy. But so far, all the nominees are still in the running or have made it through. On Wednesday night, that changed with the withdrawal of Andrew Puzder, a fast food executive who was scheduled for a Senate hearing today. Democratic senators like Elizabeth Warren had opposed Puzder's business practices from the beginning, but Trump saw something in him and was committed to his nomination.
Mr. Puzder was a big supporter of Mr. Trump. He was a donor.
Alan Rappaport covers economic policy for the Times.
He had been defending him on television.
His support is American working class and middle class individuals. He's not Now, he's not drinking wine with rich people in the Hamptons. He's in Detroit talking to African-American voters about how he's going to help create jobs and lift them out of poverty.
Which is how the president often gets to know people and becomes fond of people who happen to flatter him on TV. That's how he sort of first fell into his graces. And, you know, he's a successful businessman. He's run Hardee's and Carl's Jr. chains across the country.
What's more American than a cheeseburger? This cheeseburger, loaded with a hot dog and potato chips. In the hands of all-American model Samantha Hoops in a hot tub.
And he wanted somebody who was conservative and who also knows the problems of regulations and, you know, has a sense of how to grow the economy from that perspective.
But soon the opposition intensified and spread and became more personal.
There were also issues that were surfacing from about 30 years ago. There were allegations that he had abused his ex-wife. She has since recanted this and said that she was, you know, using this to try and get back at him for things. But this sort of became, you know, a huge issue because parts of the divorce lawsuit were unsealed this week. There was an Oprah Winfrey video from 1990.
I remember my ex-husband was a public figure. Everyone knew him and knew what he was doing.
Where his ex-wife was in disguise talking about the abusive relationship.
I will see you in the gutter. This will never be over. You will pay for this. I wound up losing everything. Mm-hmm. Everything. I have nothing. He has a Porsche and a Mercedes-Benz. He has the home. He has everything. He was
that had been leaked out, and senators of both parties watched that during two screenings last week.
So I just want to pause you because that seems quite remarkable. Members of the United States Senate sitting in a room watching a 30-year-old episode of Oprah Winfrey. How did that even come to pass?
Exactly. Well, it's not even publicly available. It was the property of Oprah's new network. She didn't want to make it publicly available, but she did make it available to the senators, Democrats on the committee. The senators who saw it said that it was disturbing and that they were prepared to make an issue out of it at his confirmation hearing on Thursday.
And there was this.
It was revealed last week that he had hired a housekeeper who was an undocumented worker who he hadn't paid taxes for, which was seen as quite ironic for somebody who was going to lead the Labor Department.
Right. So, Alan, did a single factor really stand out here, like the issue of his ex-wife and her original claims about the nature of their marriage, or was this just an accumulation of doubts and questions and controversies?
I think it was an accumulation of things. It looked like it could potentially become a very contentious hearing on Thursday. It could potentially be very embarrassing for Republicans. And, you know, once it became clear that he might not have enough votes, because there were four Republican senators who made clear yesterday that they were wavering. And because of the balance of the Senate, he could only afford to lose three. So it looked very likely that he wasn't going to make it in a full Senate vote.
It feels like this was the first time that Republicans really decided that they were going to oppose and even kill one of Trump's cabinet nominees. What does that tell us about where Republicans are with their president?
Well, this is really the first time that they've broken with him, and I think it shows that they're starting to see him as a liability in some respects. He could be weakened from the past 2 weeks, which have been quite turbulent, and it shows, you know, that there's definitely going to be more backlash ahead for him. I think it also shows that Republicans are going to have to start looking out for themselves with the midterm elections coming up next year. They want to be loyal to President Trump, but at the same time, he can be a wild card in certain respects, and they're going to have to, you know, pay attention to how some of the choices that they make and the votes that they cast are going to be viewed when voters come back to the polls next year.
At this point, how short-staffed is President Trump's cabinet?
At this point, he has 12 out of the 22 cabinet members that he nominated. So he is short-staffed, and he's pretty far behind previous administrations in terms of where they were at this point. And you're definitely sort of seeing that around Washington government agencies. You know, they feel kind of vacant. They're not up and running, and people are kind of waiting to see what's going to happen.
Alan, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me. Great to be on.
That's it for The Daily. I'm Michael Barbaro. See you tomorrow.